rules. Any questions? Okay. All right. They'll be on the committee website as also. So with that, we have a quorum, so we can begin. Where are we at? Oh, yes, thank you, Holly. Appreciate that. I missed it. I'm out of order now, so I'm in trouble. No. So before we get started, I know we probably all introduced each other in at the HHS reform policy, but I think it would be a good idea to review everybody that's on the committee, and I welcome you all there, and then our staff members also. So with that, I would like you to tell me where you're from and what your district is. So I am from District 1B, and I serve Polk, Red Lake, and Pennington County, aside from Thief River Falls. Representative Fabian has that. I reside in Crookston, well, not actually in. I'm a farmer, so I live on a farm. Not everybody does anymore. A lot of people live in town. So anyway, so with that, where are we at? Vice Chair Tama, would you please? Tice, excuse me.
That's okay. That works for me. Good morning. My name is Tama Tice. I represent District 14A, which is the west and south part of St. Cloud, Way Park, and St. Augusta. And I got lost getting here. Go figure. Went to the wrong room. So sorry for being late.
Well, we're glad you found us. Thank you. And then our DFL lead, Representative Allen.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Susan Allen, represent South Minneapolis, District 62B, and that's south of, it's like central, it's made up of a bunch of what we call neighborhoods. Like, I live in Powderhorn, and that's where the May Day parade is at, and so it, and it extends, it's a mixed income. It goes all the way to, like, Kingfield and Tangletown, which is along the Minnehaha Parkway, so it's a very diverse district.
Thank you. Representative Baker, would you like to?
Sure, Madam Chair. Thank you. Dave Baker, representing District 17D out in beautiful Wilmer and Candiota County, straight west of here, 100 miles. And it's an honor to be here. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Liz Olson. I represent District 7B, which is the western and central parts of Duluth.
Thank you. Go ahead.
My name is Cassandra Moore. I'm with DFL House Research, originally from Buffalo, Minnesota, and now in St. Paul.
Thank you. I'm Elizabeth Clarkvist with House Research, and I draft in the areas of Health Department and Public Health.
Danielle Pinelli from House Research, and I cover the aging and long-term care services that DHS administers.
Holly Iverson, Committee Administrator, and originally from Glenwood, Minnesota.
Good morning. I'm Annie Parachini. I supervise the legislative assistant staff for the GOP caucus, and I am your guest CLA today because I'm the new guys are shadowing me. So there's a new CLA in this committee, so I'm helping out.
Good morning. I'm the new guy, Peter Globa, CLA, originally from South Minneapolis, now in Eden Prairie.
Chelsea Whitman, GOP researcher for the Aging Subcommittee, and originally from Afton, Minnesota.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and everyone. My name is Representative Kathy Lohmer, and I serve 39B, District 39B, which is Stillwater and the surrounding areas along the St. Croix River. I have 13 communities. I live in Baytown Township.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Joe McDonald from 29A, City of Delano, County of Wright, representing the cities of South Haven, Annandale, Waverly, Montrose, Rockford, and Howard Lake, and several other townships. So I've been, this is my fourth term. My wife and I have a photography studio in Delano, and of course my neighbor are over there from Buffalo. Good to see you and as well. So.
Oh, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. Mike Freiberg, District 45B, all or parts of Crystal, Golden Valley, New Hope, and Robbinsdale.
Welcome. Thanks. Well, I thank you all for being here. Most of our work is going to be done early on in the session, and so if you have suggestions or input, please contact me personally, too. Our goal is to work on aging and long-term care, and that can mean a lot of different things. Today we are going to ask the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services to give us a report and a little bit of a discussion on what's happening. So with that, I will ask, is it Val Cook, to come forward and give us a... Yep. Oh, you, yes, go ahead, all three of you, come on up. Welcome to the committee, and maybe you have a different order you want to explain, so go ahead and introduce yourselves for the committee. And
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Susan Winkleman. I'm the Assistant Division Director in the Health Regulation Division in the Department of Health. And yes, we would like your permission to go in a different order.
Sure.
We selected an order that we think will make it easier for the committee to understand the materials. And then with me is Belle Cook from DHS and also Carrie Benson from DHS.
Good morning. Go ahead.
Thank you very much for inviting us to present to you today an overview. And I believe the topics that you had suggested that we talk about specifically were nursing homes and assisted living. And what we've prepared for you today, at least from the Health Department, is a fact sheet that describes actually four settings and four provider types that were really are interrelated and are important for you to understand as part of what assisted living really means too. So we started with a nursing home, and one of the things that I wanted to advise the committee too is that when you're talking about regulatory standards, you're really talking about the minimum standards that are required. So regulatory standards or licensing or any sort of regulatory oversight is it establishes the floor. And so when a provider violates the law, it's the floor. It's the minimally required standard. And so that's really a kind of typical or classical type of regulatory view of all of the regulations. The Health Regulation Division, which I'm an assistant division director of, is a regulatory division within the Department of Health, and we do many other types of regulation in addition to what we're calling long-term care providers today. And the long-term care providers today that we'll be reviewing for you, and I'll just review quickly, are nursing homes, home care providers, housing with services settings, and assisted living. And as I go through these, hopefully you'll see the interplay and the intersective points for all of them. So we'll just begin with the nursing home. And the Department of Health has provided a fact sheet, and you can just follow along. So nursing homes are what we classically think of as being long-term care. There are currently 364 licensed nursing homes and 28,700 or so beds that are licensed within. Most nursing homes are also federally certified, and the Department of Health and the Health Regulation Division has a contract with CMS to federally certify many of these nursing homes as well. And so it's a combination of a state license and a federal certification. Along with these requirements, which are health and safety based, and also include a physical plant requirement. And so there's a life safety code and some healthcare related physical plant requirements that go along with nursing homes. The most common types of violations that we see for nursing homes are that the services are not being provided according to the care plan. Of course, everyone has to have a care plan for their services. Infection control issues and issues in the area of the nurse competency, or not nurse competency, but the nursing services. So moving on, I don't know if you have any questions, but maybe if we kind of go through mine, and then if you have questions, we'll be happy to answer them. Home care providers are another part of long-term care and certainly are an emerging group in terms of numbers. Right now, there are 1,430 licensed home care providers, and 200 of these are also federally certified. There's two types of licenses that home care providers can receive, and they're basic and comprehensive. And a basic license is really assisting someone with activities of daily living, and a comprehensive license is the more stringent level of health care provision. Home care services really are an emerging field, and it can be these very, very light care all the way to very, very serious and complex medical care, and is provided in people's homes. And right now we're seeing a healthy dose of people who live in their own private homes, so, you know, individual homes, individual farms, wherever they live, or else they're moving into housing with services, and we'll get into that a little bit later. And when you think of housing with services, it's an apartment building. That's how I always tell people to visualize it. Think apartment building, but we'll get more into what that means. In 2013, there were very, very significant changes that the legislature enacted regarding home care services, and there was a rehaul of the licensing structure. There are many new changes in terms of the minimum qualifications. We added a temporary license period, and then also the budget increased significantly, so that the goal would be to be able to survey every home care provider once within 3 years. We are in year three of this 5-year implementation period, and we are not yet at our once every 3-year goal, but we are making some headway, and we're encountering the very serious issues that we were imagining were actually out there. Housing with services settings are the next important overview item that we wanted to go through. It may not be something that's intuitive. It's not something that people run around saying, housing with services, but it's a really, really a key and important part of all of this long-term care, especially as it relates to home care and assisted living. Housing with services, as I mentioned before, is where home care services are often provided, and the visual is really an apartment building for seniors. The statutory definition for housing with services is that it provides sleeping accommodations for adults, at least 80 of which are 55 years old or older, and that there are various services provided within the building that are provided for a fee, and they would be along the lines of health care provision and or supportive services. And so health care is really translates into home care, and the supportive services is really dining or laundry or some sort of van transportation to appointments or groceries. So housing with services establishments are not licensed, they are registered through the Department of Health. And so what we mean by registration is that it's more like a list and less like a license. We talked about home care and nursing homes, both of which are licensed. And that comes with a full gamut of entry requirements and requirements to maintain the license, full oversight by the health department for complaints, receiving complaints and investigating those, and also enforcement actions of taking it away. A registration is different. A registration does not come with all the things that a license does, and that's what housing with services are registered. So with the requirements that the activities that the health department takes regarding housing with services are that we receive the application, and there also is a uniform consumer information guide that is required for all housing with services. And it was an innovation of 10 plus years ago to try to help the consumer figure out what's the difference between these places, and it's information that the provider provides to us during their application process. We ship it over to DHS, and they do some magic crunching, and it comes out in some sort of comparative review for consumers. But it doesn't grade them. It's just the information that they provided so that it's able to be shared in a format that's more usable for the consumer. And so they provide that information to us. We make sure their application is complete. We take their fee, and then they are on the list. Now, let me just go into assisted living designations, because the connector is really between housing with services and assisted living. So everyone talks about assisted living, and we think we know what it is, but really in Minnesota, it's a little more unique. All the states kind of have their own way of doing it. And so assisted living is a designation on top of a housing with services. Assisted living cannot exist without first being associated with a registered housing with services. And so it's a protected title, really. And if you're familiar with regulation, you know, you have the most restrictive form of regulation, which is a license, all the way to registration on the lower end, and a protected title or a designation is the least restrictive form of regulation you can have. So assisted living designation, it would first have to be in a housing with services that says we want to designate ourselves as an assisted living. And so there, out of the 1,474 registered housing with services, there are 1,144 assisted living designations. So you can see it's pretty popular because many of the housing with services have chosen that designation. So the designation means that they are meeting all of the requirements for what is an assisted living, and it includes having an on-call RN 24/7. It includes providing a way for the clients to request assistance 24/7, and there are many other requirements. Now, we're finding in some of our numbers that the marketplace is always changing, and it's certainly changing in this area a lot too. And so we're finding that about 529 housing with services are providing care for cognitively impaired persons, but not choosing the assisted living designation. We don't have any sense that this is bad or good. It's just a marketplace change. And so maybe the terminology of assisted living now comes with some sort of meaning that's extra and people don't want to use it, or we're not sure. But it's just something that's emerging, and it's somewhat of a trend that housing with services are choosing, at least 500 of them are choosing to provide care for cognitively impaired people, but not choosing to designate themselves as assisted living. But 500 is not as many as 1,100 who are. So that is a very, very, very tippy-top overview of the landscape, at least that the Health Regulation Division and the Health Department is responsible for regarding some of these long-term care providers. And I'll just stop there.
Thank you, Ms. Wiggleman. Maybe this is a good time to ask members, is there anyone that has questions? Representative McDonald?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious, and maybe this question you could answer, or if not, our testifier. I see that there's, as far as the beds for assisted living, there's none in Cook County. I see. Cook or Travers County. So I'm just curious as to why that is. And that's on the page. This facts and figures, the back page, it just states that before the graft.
Ms. Winkleman?
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe the geographic pages are from DHS, and I couldn't answer why. There wouldn't be one in every county, but we know that people are where they are, and they're choosing their businesses the way they are, so I don't have any firm answer for why that is.
Thank you. Representative McDonald, what I know about it is I've had one shut down, and they just financially couldn't keep going. But I see in Red Lake County they've added another one. So actually they remade a nursing home is what they ended up doing. So, but I know there's some financial balances with, and we'll get into it next week a little more, about elderly waiver, and it's a complicated system. That's the best I can explain. But anyway, Representative Baker, do you have a...
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to maybe wait till the end of this for this question because maybe more presentations might do this. Sorry. I've had an issue with some of our friends back home about long-term care insurance when it comes to assisted living facilities. And some of them are not part of the insurance acceptability to pay insurance at those facilities because they may not have licensed nursing there 24/7, even though they're on call all the time. So again, Madam Chair, this may not be the right time to ask this the testifiers this question. I'm just curious if there's actually any discussions about that on the state level, or if this is more of an insurance company question that we can deal with at a later time. But I know folks have been paying insurance for a long time, and when they find a place they want to go to, they are turned away for the insurance benefits that they've been paying for years and years. And I just think this is an issue that we should address, and I don't know if the department can help us with any of that or if there is some changes that we need to make that could help that. But again, I'm concerned about that important issue of seeing clients get their benefits due to them from paying these kind of things. So I'm going to throw it out there, Madam Chair. I'm not sure if that's a question or more of a statement, but if you can help me with any of that, that'd be great. Thank you.
Ms. Coleman, do you have any comment at this time?
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, you raise a really important point about how services get paid for, specifically from the department. I'm not as aware acutely as you are about these facts, so it's something that we would want to hear more about. But you raise a really important point.
Ms. Benson, did you have a...
Madam Chair, just to respond at least briefly, and then we could circle back to this as well. There's an initiative out of the Department of Human Services that is called the Own Your Future Initiative. And the focus at this point in time of that initiative is really working through financing alternatives to long-term care insurance. But they continue to work towards educating individuals about their long-term care insurance policies, so those individuals especially who have existing policies in place, and helping to get information out so people do have a better understanding of exactly what is covered in those policies, because there are quite a few challenges with that. And there are limitations. So there are limitations that we're finding that as individuals, even now, there's such a limited array of options available as far as those products. And so either if you've purchased it in the past and you're wanting to start using it now, there's a lot of challenges that people are experiencing. And there are much fewer providers offering that option. And it just doesn't fit for everybody. It just doesn't work. You know, it's not affordable for individuals with low to mid-range incomes. It's it doesn't necessarily, a product that you might be offered doesn't necessarily pay for the services that you really will want. So there's a lot of challenges that the department is working through. So we'd be happy to come in and talk about that more, offer some more information, or however you would like to follow up, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I think maybe that's something we should look into, and we'll spend some time talking about that. I know it is challenging, and it is costly, and I have an aunt that we took care of, and she was very planned, and she used it for a week. So a lot of money put into, I know if she could review it now, she'd be like, I could have put money away for that. So, but that's the way life is, so. Anyway, that's the subject that we'll revisit. So any other questions? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Winkleman, could you speak to that point that you just raised about the designation with the housing with services settings and folks with cognitive disabilities, that 500 or so, like why that's happening, what to the point that you were making just about that they don't seek more than serving the folks with cognitive disabilities at that designation level? And I was just kind of curious what your thoughts are about that.
Ms. Winkleman.
Madam Chair, Representative, I can go into some detail, but I don't know that we have any particular information about it. It's just more of an observation about perhaps a market change. I think that in the area of home care, we're constantly seeing market changes. and especially regarding cognitively impaired persons, and that could be the whole range from brain injury all the way to dementia. So it's a variety of people. Perhaps I'm not positive of the timing of the assisted living designation. It's been in place for many, many years, and that may have been the going term and the desirable term, and now things are changing a little bit. I think what's important to understand about the landscape of our regulation is that you have licenses and you have registrations, and you just need to understand the distinctions. That for nursing homes, there's a physical plant requirement, and then for housing the services, it's a registration. And so it's just a difference. I think there are definite pros and cons with the way that Minnesota has chosen it, and we don't want to belittle that at all. Home care services being licensed wherever the services are being provided is really the hook into how we care for cognitively impaired persons. So that's something to keep in mind, too. I don't know that I've answered your question, but maybe try to give you a bit more information.
Thank you. The follow-up at all? Okay. Any other questions? So let's move on. Who's next?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Benson.
Madam Chair and members, good to be here with you today. I should have introduced myself in response to that first question that I answered, but I am Carrie Benson, Director of the Aging and Adult Services Division at the Department of Human Services, and in that role I also serve as Executive Director of the Minnesota Board on Aging. I'll be providing an overview of DHS's role as it relates to assisted living, primarily as payer, developer, and then, as I like to say, supporter of quality improvement, and we'll touch on that towards the end of my presentation. I'm really happy to follow Susan from the Health Department in my presentation, because I think Susan provided a great foundation to base our presentations on from DHS, and hopefully as you hear our presentations, you'll see the many different ways, the connections across our departments and with other partners that we've been working together over the years to really work with all of you and work towards a system that really provides a range of services, range of options for older adults across the state and their communities. I will be touching on a few items in more detail in my presentation, but I did want to just step back a little bit, and I'm hoping it'll be helpful for all of you. I provided a timeline document. I don't know if you have received that, but we developed it initially to recap Reform 2020, which was a fairly recent reform effort that the Department of Human Services underwent across the Aging and Disability Services areas, and many, many different reforms were a part of that initiative, both coming out of legislative session at the time, the 2013 in particular, but also from the federal level. But what we found is that even though we developed that document for that purpose, the timeline on the one side of that document does help all of us, even just internally, stay grounded in how did we actually get here? What were the steps, at least some of the pretty high-level important steps that we've taken as a state to develop the system that we have in place? So I do want to walk through and just highlight a few of those for you, and hoping that it will be a good reference document for you as well. So as you can see, the document goes pretty far back into the history of the development of our system of long-term services and supports. For older adults, you'll see items that highlight steps taken to develop services models for individuals with disabilities younger than age 65 as well. I'll focus on the older adult end of the continuum in highlighting a few things. So you'll see before 1970, we really didn't have many options at all. There were just the beginning steps in terms of developing nursing homes. As Susan was mentioning, that's really when you say long-term care, or we've been shifting more to saying long-term services and supports. That's generally what people think of. That's what they see. That's the noticeable version or option that people think of. And so that started really in the mid-60s. in the 70s, then we saw the establishment of the Older Americans Act, the implementation of different Medicaid options. You'll see the Medicaid waiver programs coming into place in the 80s, but that's really the beginnings of the federal oversight, the federal authority to states to develop options beyond nursing homes. So that was really our first efforts to develop what I'll refer to probably quite a few times as our range of options that we would like to see in all communities in this state for older adults. So that range of options, including nursing homes, assisted living facilities, but also other options that individuals might access, including services in their own home. In the 1980s, you'll see just even from the title on that column, institutional uses tighten, community options grow. So you'll see in the 1985, the moratorium to curtail certifying new beds in nursing homes. So starting to then put in some limits in place for managing the supply, the capacity of the nursing home industry, nursing home capacity, and then a continued focus on both beefing up our information, our assistance we provide to older adults, to family members. We probably all know, just even from our personal experience, that most long-term care is provided by families. In a fairly recent survey, we were asking individuals age 50 and older if they provided assistance to anybody, family, friend. And there was a little over 70% of those respondents that said, absolutely, I provide care, and quite a few of them provide pretty intensive services. So the family support is a big piece of this, too. Susan did refer to a piece related to the Housing with Services, the Uniform Consumer Information Guide. That's a piece of the range of information, I should say, that we make available in a collaborative effort to individuals who are seeking options and trying to figure out what option makes the most sense to them. In 95, you'll see there's a state task force on housing and services that really was the first to create this housing and services establishment, that designation, and so that goes back to the mid-90s. Then in the 2000s, in the year 2000, there was a long-term care task force that included both legislative members, executive branch members, and it was a very important group that came together and crafted a vision for our long-term services and support system that we've really been working towards as a state ever since. And you will see in some of the items listed in that column in the 2000s that there were some pretty major investments, especially in terms of developing the home and community-based services alternatives to nursing homes. And then in the 2010s or 2010s, there were additional pieces in place, some of which I will highlight in my overview when I walk through the fact sheet that we have, the long-term care options counseling, and just really continuing to refine our efforts to reach older adults at critical stages or critical junctures in their need for more assistance, more support, and really plugging that in to help them and their families make sense of our system. As I think we all know, it can be pretty difficult to figure out how to navigate it in any particular situation. So we've made some headway in that area as well that I can highlight. And I believe Val might touch on some of those items as well, but I do hope that's a helpful reference document for all of you as we move forward with our discussions. So with that, I was planning to move on to the fact sheet that we put together, the assisted living facts and figures from the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Susan covered the first sections of the fact sheet that we have here. There's overlap in terms of the content, so I won't go over that again. But what I would like to draw your attention to is the third section in terms of how services are paid for in assisted living establishments. So assisted living establishments, and these are the establishments that are designated as assisted living, as Susan explain to all of you. Typically, there are more individuals in those establishments that are using their own funds to pay for the services that they need, and as well as the rent that they need to pay to be able to live in those establishments. But there are individuals who qualify for public programs, in particular the Elderly Waiver Program, and they receive their services then paid for through the Elderly Waiver Program based on income and asset eligibility as well as functional eligibility for the program. So EW program, which is one that we administer at the Department of Human Services, we pay for a range of services, and we call this bundle of services customized living. And the bundle itself is individualized for each person and could include one or more of the services that Susan was referring to in her presentation and that we've provided examples for in the previous section in the fact sheet. Like all medical assistance, Elderly Waiver does not pay for room and board. It just pays for the services available that an individual needs in that setting based on their service needs, their functional level. In fiscal year 2016, a total of 11,845 people received customized living services paid through the Elderly Waiver Program. That's under half of the individuals that received services overall through the Elderly Waiver Program. In that year, we served about 29,000 individuals through Elderly Waivers. So you'll see there's under half of those individuals received the customized living service bundle. Other individuals were primarily living in their own home, single family home, receiving services there. And that, again, could be a whole range of services that could include chore, homemaker services, all the way to assistance with activities of daily living, such as bathing, dressing, eating, and such. So it could be quite a range. And we just provided a few statistics on the demographics of individuals who are served through the Elderly Waiver Program. It's definitely an older population on the range of eligible individuals, 65 and older. We do tend to serve people around the average age of 84, and most are women. Susan touched on the admittance to an assisted living establishment in her presentation. What I would like to add to that is to explain to all of you, so you're aware of a step that is required for individuals to take and for housing services establishments to follow in order for us to be sure that they are receiving information and assistance in really understanding their full range of options. So individuals prior to completing a lease in a housing services establishment need to call the senior linkage line. That's a 1-800 number that's available during the business hours, work days, all across the state, actually nationally as well, that individuals can call to receive long-term care options counseling. Individuals considering a move to assisted living need to call that number to speak to one of the community living specialists to have a brief conversation, if they are willing and interested in doing that, to understand their options. So this is one of the mechanisms or the steps we've put in place authorized by the 2011 legislature that we've put into place then since then to really catch folks at that critical time where they're trying to make a decision, really trying to have good information at hand to know, is this option that I'm considering, is that the best fit for me, or are there other ways where I can get the assistance I need and maybe stay in my own home, single family home, without having to move. Very individualized decision-making process, and one that we've worked through with quite a few people. So I wanted to make sure that you were aware of that as well. Now I would like to switch gears and talk a little bit more about the capacity for assisted living, of assisted living, I should say, in the state. So we had referenced earlier, Representative McDonald had referenced the map that we have of assisted living locations. You also have the nursing home locations, and Val might speak to that in her presentation. We wanted to provide this to you as a way to just see what is the status? Where are these facilities actually located? What you're seeing on this map are the establishments, the apartment buildings that have been designated as assisted living. So this is that subset that Susan explained to all of you. And this is just under 1,200 locations in the state. And on the fact sheet, we do note that there are assisted living beds in all of the counties except for Cook and Traverse. One of the other roles that the Department of Human Services plays through the Aging and Adult Services Division is really working closely with local organizations around the state to develop capacity, to bring up alternatives to nursing facilities in particular so that people do have that range of options. We do this primarily through funding available through the Live Well at Home grant program. That's an annual competitive request for proposal process that we go through to award grants to organizations that want to develop a new model that identify a gap in a service that's needed. It could be a gap in chore service. It could be a gap in transportation service. It could be a gap in assisted living. And that for us is, under the Live Well at Home grant program, is pretty broadly defined. So we really work with communities to develop the options that make sense to them, that's a good fit to them, that they've got an interest in developing. And so it more so follows that definition that Susan had mentioned real early on in her presentation, that is assisted living kind of in the popular vernacular, that, you know, we it all means something different to, I think, all of us. That could be, you know, apartment building with maybe just a meal program, maybe some activities coming in, exercise programs, what have you, all the way to one of these locations that's a subset of assisted living facilities. And what we also do through the Live Well at Home grant program and through our other efforts to support local communities in developing these alternatives, developing this capacity, is we're really working towards developing the capacity to serve individuals regardless of payer source, we call it. But basically, whether or not you've got private resources, funds to spend on your services, on your housing, or if you might be eligible for one of the programs that we administer. So we really want this available, these different options available across the board, no matter funding source. One of the things I wanted to mention about the capacity is that as compared to other states in the country, especially in, you know, I'll go back now even to the timeline that we were just looking at, you know, in the 80s and I would say into the 90s as well, we were really Minnesota was known for having the most nursing home beds for its older adult population. And that's really shifted, where we've put a lot of the strategies in place that you've seen in that timeline document and what I've been talking about to build up the home and community-based services capacity. Part of that has included the growth in assisted living facilities, and that's when you look at state-by-state comparisons, that again is that broader definition that's not necessarily squarely focused on that subset. So more with the housing with services, that we now have the most assisted living beds for our older adult population as compared to other states. And so that's just a fact of our system and a characteristic of that. But it by no means points to that we can check it off our list, you know, that type of option is as available as it should be in every community or every county in the state. So which I believe Representative McDonald probably goes to your question and that you had highlighted earlier. So just wanted to mention that in case that's helpful for all of you to just get a sense of where we're at with our system as a whole and how does it compare at least in a few ways to other states too. Last point I'd like to make is just on that bar chart on the bottom of our fact sheet is assisted living beds per 1,000 by county. You'll see most are the smaller facilities, you know, the 1 to 50 beds, but ranging into then the 51 to 100 beds per 1,000. So you do see that there are, you know, some of the larger facilities, but there's quite a range. And I think that speaks to then, you know, the different options and the different needs and interests of the market in different communities as well. So I think with that, I will end there.
Thank you, Ms. Benson. Members, does anyone have any questions of Ms. Benson at this time? I would like to ask you one thing, and I don't know if we have any information about this, but my personal experience in assisted living is I'm noticing that more of our assisted livings are having people that are needing more services that are not necessarily probably 10, 15 years ago we would have said needed to live in a nursing home. And now assisted living is providing more of that. And I know we also encourage elderly to, it used to be when I was younger, a kid, that nursing homes were served patients. They sat pretty much all day. And now we provide a lot of activities and require that they move and do things so because it's better for their health. But I'm wondering, do you notice that within the department, that that is what's happening? Ms. Benson.
Madam Chair, yes, we do notice that trend happening as well. And Val will touch on some of the statistics or trends from the nursing home perspective related to that. But in terms of assisted living, we do see that trend. And we see it partly as a variation on the theme of aging in place, where really wherever a person feels that their home is, you know, that if they're living in their single family home, they would really like to stay there, you know, and get services there if they can make it work. That's not always the case. Sometimes it's the adult children too that have concerns about their safety, that need some peace of mind. So that's different factors feed into the decision, you know, to move to assisted living. But then an individual, as when they're in assisted living, that's really their home. And so they really do prefer, on average, we hear, to really stay there, to really age in place, to really get the services and be able to access more intensive, I guess I could say, services, assistance as they need it without having to move again. And so we do hear about that. We're seeing increasing challenges in supporting individuals with mental health conditions, along with physical need for physical assistance and such, that there's the complexity, cognitive limitations, memory loss. You know, there's a lot of challenges that we're hearing about from assisted living providers in terms of really fully supporting it, the individuals that are currently living in their settings and helping them age in place. One of the things I just want to mention that I think is really promising is technology in that area. There's a number of factors I think we as a state need to consider, but I do feel that technology is one of them, and we are seeing with some models that we're supporting through the Livewell at Home grant program, that sensory technology, if we put that into a senior housing building, apartment building, might be subsidized, might not be assisted living designated, that helps with that being on call, basically, that I fall in and I can't get up, that emergency assistance, that monitor to be able to monitor if maybe you know, the individual hasn't gotten out of bed, maybe have they not opened their fridge, those types of things that we've seen, that holds some promise. And also some other technologies where people can stay connected socially through sites on their computer if they're open to using that, or even through the TV. But there's ways that we've been able to really put in some of those connections and those safeguards in place that I think hold promise for us into the future.
Thank you. Representative McDonald, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I think this question will be for Ms. Benson. In regards to companies such as Visiting Angels, is an elderly waiver, is that, are they eligible to receive that?
Ms. Benson.
Madam Chair, Representative, services provided by Visiting Angels Nursing Service are services that if an individual is receiving them that they are and they are on the elderly waiver program, those services could be reimbursed. It depends on the details of what the services are, but elderly waiver program generally covers quite a large range of services to help a person in their own home. And so typically those might be from a Visiting Angels Nursing Service might be more the personal assistance, personal care assistance, those types of things, and those could be reimbursed based on the individual's needs and eligibility.
Thank you. Representative McDonald.
Madam Chair, thank you. And then just a completely different question. Are you aware of some nursing homes in Minnesota that were not sharing the increase in payment for their employees from the legislation that we passed 2 years ago?
Ms. Benson.
Madam Chair, Representative, I do not have that information, and I will let my colleague Val Cook address that, whether or not that information is available yet from the department.
Okay, thank you. Is there any other questions?
Madam Chair, just if I may follow up,
excuse
I'm sorry.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Yes, Representative.
I just want to quantify why I asked that. In my district, in the city of Delano, I have some residents that have been contacting me through a messenger on Facebook for the last 2 years. And the nursing home in Delano, according to her, did not increase their salary based upon our legislation in 2015, I believe. So, and I believe that Representative Schumacher had sent a letter to the organization, the company that has, I won't name them right now. They have several nursing homes. But so if other members have experienced that, or if staff has heard that, or if those from the department are aware of that, that seems to be, that's definitely a problem, since by law they were required to give a pay increase to those who are taking care of the most vulnerable and our elderly. And I just want to make that aware and would offer or enjoy any help that I could to help my constituent.
Thank you. Just information, we're gonna talk about that in a later conversation about, you know, what we did and how it's working and what the results were. So I have opposite stories, so it'll be interesting to see where we're at with that. So, Representative Baker?
No, I'll pass. Thanks.
Okay. Anyone else? All right. Thank you. Ms. Cook, would you like to help us out with the rest of the story?
Good morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Valerie Cook, and I'm the Division Director for the Nursing Facility Rates and Policy Division. And so you've been given a lot of information about nursing homes so far, so I'm just going to try to highlight additional new information from our division's perspective. So our primary responsibilities are to develop and implement policies that are related to nursing facilities. We also have a large effort in affecting quality in nursing homes. And so what we do beyond what Susan talked about is, you know, as the regulatory agency is looking at minimum requirements. And so we have a pretty robust quality strategy that I'll talk a little bit more about to try to improve quality beyond those minimum standards. And so then a primary third role for us is to establish payment rates for the nursing facilities. So just to distinguish, too, from assisted living, nursing facilities, rates are set up on a daily per diem rate, and what's included in that does include room and board and nursing services primarily. So therapy services, prescription drugs, and those medical kinds of things are billed separately. They could be billed by Medicaid or some other payer source, but just wanted to clarify mostly what we're talking about here today is this daily per diem. Again, to talk about, you know, how does a person get admitted to a nursing facility, and we do go through a similar assessment process that Carrie spoke of. Primarily, almost all nursing home admissions are coming from a hospital, and so that pre-admission screen would occur in the hospital to determine that the person will meet a level of care, a level of need for that would be require nursing home services. So there's that kind of process. And then to talk about, so what does nursing facility cost and who pays for it? About $2 billion a year is actually spent in nursing homes in Minnesota. And if you want to look, if you're following along in the fact sheet, if you just want to flip over to the back side, I can just sort of describe how the various payer sources that go into that $2 billion. So Medicaid actually spends less than half of that $2 billion. But when you see the Medicaid graph there, the 54%, that includes, even if a person is Medicaid eligible in nursing home, they do contribute some personal resources. So that 54% represents spending that's done with people that are Medicaid eligible. So there could be managed care contribution there too, as well as personal resources. The average daily rate across the state is about $226 a day, and nursing facilities are paid possibly a rate out of different case mix levels, and then each facility has a distinct set of case mix level rates. And so it gets to be, it's a pretty complex payment system, actually. But a nursing home resident, when they are admitted to the nursing home, go through a pretty extensive assessment process. And the results of that assessment determines their care plan needs and then places them in a case mix classification that establishes their rate. The other interesting thing about is, you know, we've been talking a little bit about market changes, and we have about 61,000 admissions at least a year in nursing homes, and you'll notice that we've got about 28,000 active beds. So half of those that, or let's see, 50% of those admissions to the nursing home, that person's been discharged back to the community before 30 days. So there's a lot of activity and churning going on in that first 30 days. So only 35% of folks that are admitted to the nursing facility actually stay longer than 90 days. And so I think that's a big change in what you're seeing when we talk about the traditional nursing home from back in the early 1980s. So we've talked, or Carrie's talked a little bit too about, you know, what's happening with the size of the nursing home industry. And back in the number of facilities we had in 1987, so 25 to 30 years ago, we peaked at like 486. So we're down about to 380, or fewer than that, I guess. So over 100 nursing facilities have closed in the last 25 years. So the actual utilization of nursing homes has dropped quite dramatically. So to touch a little bit on how nursing facility rates are set, one thing to point out is Minnesota is a rate equalization state, and so what that means is that the department sets the medical assistance payment rates for the facilities, and then that establishes the private pay rate as well for those folks that are paying out of their own private funds. The exception to that is that the rate equalization law does not apply if a person is in a single room. And so about half of the beds that we have in the state today are actually in single rooms. And so that's another big transition that's been occurring over the years, is moving to single bedrooms. And I think that, Representative, you touched on the value-based reimbursement that I'll just touch on a little bit. In 2015, the legislature passed a major reform for how medical assistance payment rates are set in nursing facilities. Part of the goal of that reform was to provide resources for nursing facilities to invest in their workforce. And there's also a quality component to value-based reimbursement. And so basically what VBR does, it was a rate-setting change, and what we moved to a cost-based model that uses quality scores for a facility to adjust their limits as to how high that we will set their rates. And then it also uses a pricing model for some of their other operating costs. So it's a pretty big change from how rates have been traditionally set over the last few years. And so that kind of sets the stage for me to talk a little bit about our nursing home quality strategy. And so given, you know, the investment that the state is making in nursing facilities, we have put a big effort into developing a robust quality strategy. And in the, on the backside, again, of the fact sheet, there's just sort of a graphic of what that looks like. It's kind of a three-prong approach. For the last several years, we have worked closely with the Department of Health, some of, and our stakeholders and other experts in the quality measurement field, and developed quite a large set of quality indicators. And they're a mixture of resident quality of life, consumer satisfaction, family satisfaction, data that we collect on an annual basis. We have a mixture of clinical quality indicators. We have about 25 that include things like rates of infection, falls, psychotropic drug use, et cetera. We measure how frequently people that are admitted to a facility are returned to the hospital unnecessarily. We also measure the rates of community discharge, which we obviously are, you know, as we've been talking about this morning, our goal is for people to be able to age where they would like to be. And so we encourage, there's incentives for nursing facilities to support that return to the community. And we also have some measures on staffing levels, and we also incorporate findings from the Department of Health survey findings as well. And then we did, together with the Department of Health, but in 2006, we launched the Minnesota Nursing Home Report Card as an the incentive to the nursing facilities is to, due to public disclosure, they would, you know, they want to do as well as they can on the quality measures. And it's also a great resource for consumers that are looking for a nursing facility so that they can make some side-by-side comparisons on how facilities are performing on these various quality measures. And then the third approach is with some financial incentives. We have a couple of programs that provide incentives to nursing facilities to achieve quality improvement goals from some base to some improved target. They will be financially rewarded with that. And then we also have the value-based reimbursement system that we briefly have touched on here, that if a facility scores higher on all of these measures, they have the ability to potentially have a higher limit to their rates, and so the idea being that the state's willing to pay more for higher quality services. And so that's kind of an incentive that rewards high performance. So we have a nice mixture of incentives for facilities that have room to improve, but they still can access some resources to help them do that. And with that, I think I'm ready for questions.
Okay, thank you. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this question might be for Ms. Cook. last year, maybe 2 years ago, I carried a bill with receivership when it came to nursing homes. And I think it was more of an agency desire that we were able to have the nursing or the department step in quicker when these kind of things have to happen, when a nursing home is in financial trouble. Just curious, has there been many, if any, receivership issues over the last year or two? Have the changes we've made helped? Has it gotten clunky? You know, I'm just kind of looking for any kind of update that we sometimes don't hear about when you work on a bill for the agency to see how it kind of, I'm looking for an update on that, please.
Ms. Cook.
Oh,
sorry. Ms. Winkleman.
Sorry, Madam Chair. Representative Baker, thank you for asking the question. Representative Baker is talking about nursing home receiverships, which are a Department of Health initiative when things are so dire that there's no other choice but for the state to come in and become the operator of the nursing home. And there were changes that were made in, I guess it was a couple of years ago, and that was allowed us to create a list in advance of possible managing agents for nursing homes under the receivership court order if we had to undertake that. And we're happily reporting that even though there was a receivership that was happening coincidingly with the bill process, which was awkward, but we have not had any receivership since then. And we're always very, very relieved when that happens. I think that when nursing homes are in that much difficulty, the receivership is always the option of absolute last resort, but we have not had any receivership since then.
Thank you. Representative Baker?
That's it, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Thanks.
Representative Allen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question for the directors is about the release of nursing homes and the funding. So you say that $2 billion is the annual cost for spent on nursing care facility care. And so then a little less than half of that, I think you said, is from federal funding. So as you probably know, one of the proposals being discussed by the incoming federal administration and GOP Congress is to convert Medicaid funding to block grants. And so would you comment on the potential impact and what potential cuts would be made? It doesn't really say here how much state dollars goes towards, but if you could talk about that.
Ms. Cook?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know exactly what the impact of block grants would be, but I can answer your question that Minnesota gets about 50% federal match, and so the figure that's here, which is, you know, fiscal year 16 spending, so state dollars of that would be about $400 million. But we know with value-based reimbursement, there's some growth expected in the nursing facility rates, too. But I have not been part of I would not be able to respond to what the impact of block grants might be.
Thank you. Representative Allen, do you have any?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just reading the history, it's going from in the 1950s that we the families took care of the elderly and they're disabled, and it appears as though we're going back to that to keep them into the community and into the home, and longer it saves money, and it's always good for the individuals to be in their home, and then families taking care of their loved ones. So it is a great succession, and I think a great success of the state, that we truly care for our elderly and our sick and the disabled, and keeping them back in the community. What more can we do to improve upon, in your expert opinion, and what can this committee do to keep that momentum going? It's not perfect, nothing will be perfect, but what can we do, in your opinion, with legislation that we can continue the great momentum that those before us have done to ensure that our elderly are taken care of and are happy and healthy in their own homes as well?
Who would like to answer that?
Madam Chair, I would love to answer that.
Ms. Benson.
Madam Chair and Representative, I just greatly appreciate your interest and support in this area and your passion for this too, as we all share that. And, you know, I think there are a lot of steps that we can take, and as we're looking to the first year of the baby boomers hitting the age of 85 is the year 2030. We're really looking at this time period starting now. You know, we're just a little over halfway there between when we had the long-term care task force that I mentioned earlier, that had legislative and executive branch membership that really defined the vision for the system, for older adults in particular, that really sparked, you know, some pretty major investments and a number of efforts to shape the long-term services and support system. We're a little over halfway between that and 2030, when there will be a significant increase in just the sheer number of older adults in our state, and then, of course, as a result of that, the number of individuals who need services. And so one of the overarching pressures, but also opportunities we feel that we face as a state, is really taking some time to review the vision and review what progress we've made and what new steps or refined steps do we need to take as a state that really can get us the last part of the way to a system that really works for people, that's flexible, that's easy to understand, that helps them, as you were saying, helps them live where they want to live and get the help that they need and supports families so they can stay healthy and, you know, an important part of their loved ones' lives. So I guess as just a really high-level initial response for you, I would like to offer that up, that that's something that we're thinking about from the Minnesota Board on Aging and the Department of Human Services, to that there's a great need for that type of an effort. Because I do think, you know, we don't have all the answers in terms of what steps we need to take necessarily, because I feel that we're putting in place good foundational pieces where we've got the infrastructure available for different service options for people. We've got the infrastructure built up to a good degree in terms of providing information and assistance to people, but there are still gaps, and we see some of those in when older adults and their families are trying to help them transition between settings. You know, so just as an example, that there's gaps, or there's pieces within the system overall that we really need to respond to and address. And it's going to take more than probably having the same conversation we've been having and thinking through the same strategies, that we're really wanting to move towards a process that we can engage the broader community, communities across the state, in that discussion and really see how we could kind of break out of maybe some of the strategies and really think about, well, what could it be, you know, to really capitalize on that opportunity, and what do older adults themselves, you know, current and all of us hopefully reaching that age where, you know, what would we want, and really to frame it that way and really hear from you know, the people who are currently needing services and supports, and we can learn a lot from them. So I didn't provide a lot of specifics, but would appreciate opportunities to do that more into the future tour or today if you'd like to. But just wanted to offer up those thoughts. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Benson. Representative McDonald, do you have any?
No, just I think you answered that very well, and we're excited to work with you as well. I know one bit of information as we get older, one advice from a builder, home builder in Delano said, he said, the best advice I could give you, McDonald, is to build a new home with one level, no stairs. That'll ensure you can stay into your house. So.
Yes, it is a very challenging, my parents have a split entry house. They intend on staying there. My father will turn 80 this year. I hope they can. He had a back problem and crawled up the stairs because he was coming home. So anyway, yes, it is a very challenging subject because we want as much independence. And I think as seniors, seniors are much more healthy when they have that independence too. They can make choices and then they're willing to follow along. Aside from the fact that when you get Alzheimer's or dementia, then that becomes a different issue. So. And I want to thank you all. Is there any other questions at all? Looks like we're going to finish early, I guess. The one thing I neglected to do is our page still here? There's Franklin. Franklin, would you introduce yourself? I neglected to introduce Franklin when we introduced all the members. So. Yes, if you would tell us who you are and where you're from. We'll hear better when you're down here, too. Thank you.
I am Franklin Berg. I am a committee page, or I should be the permanent page for this subcommittee. I am from Lake Elmo, Minnesota, which is actually Representative Lomer's district, but she left.
Well, welcome, and we're glad to hear that you'll be hanging around. It's very important to have our pages. So, thank you. And I thank you all, Ms. Benson, Ms. Cook, and Ms. Winkleman, for coming. I'm sure we'll probably see you again. We are certainly going to have some more questions, and I would urge members too, if you have concerns or ideas that we want to be hearing, certainly get those to us. And I got to make sure I wrap this up right. Our next meeting is next week, Wednesday, February 25th. And the subcommittee will be hearing an overview presentation on the elderly waiver and the home and community based services, so more ongoing conversation about aging and long-term care. So with that, oh, yes, Representative Baker.
Madam Chair, just with a question about scheduling now, is our schedule firmed up on our calendars for the next several weeks, few weeks?
Yes.
Okay, just want to make sure we can plan that around this. Okay.
I would for sure plan at least the next 8 weeks. So
okay,
we'll know better when we have deadlines on
Thank
our
you.
Committees. So, and with that, we're adjourned.